Well, good afternoon. Let me start off by saying thanks to Phyllis for inviting me along to give this opening talk, and thanks to the ESA for some funds towards my travel costs. As you can see, I'm due to talk about cover crops and their role in enhancing biocontrol, but I've taken the liberty of adopting a rather wide definition of what a cover crop is about, as you'll see shortly. But really the main thrust of my talk is that although we can get some enhancement of biocontrol with various forms of vegetational diversity in agricultural systems, the really neat thing is that we can also get other ecosystem services at the same time. Since I'm the first speaker in this session, I thought what I'd do initially is show a couple of slides that kind of sets the big picture theme for the overall session. And if I'd been better organised, I'd have spoken with Phyllis beforehand, because this is kind of revising what you've just told us. Okay, so we know that many natural enemies benefit from the presence of flowering plants, and not all crops flower, at least they don't necessarily flower for long enough or at the right time of the season to provide these nectar and pollen resources to natural enemies at the right time and place. And that's why cover crops and other forms of vegetational diversity can be so powerful in enhancing biocontrol for insects like these syrphids that you see here taking pollen. Now this is really important in agricultural pest management and biocontrol, because classical biocontrol has got a very poor success rate. As perhaps you're aware, it hovers at about 10%. It's not very good, and arguably one reason for that is that it's based on a very simplistic trophic model. In other words, if we've got a crop plant here being attacked by a pest, then the classical biocontrol researcher would go away and find something that eats or parasitizes that pest and bring it in. You know, it's kind of a very simple food chain. And as Phyllis indicated with her diagram, which I'll kind of replicate here with my own version, the reality is that pest management occurs in a far more intricate food web than that initial food chain that I showed might suggest. So with that very kind of broad introduction to the theme, let me get into the particular stuff that I'm going to talk about from my own group. And I'll spend most of my time presenting a kind of a case study from Australia on shelter belts in pastoral systems, where we've used cover crops and other approaches that I'll talk about shortly. And as you'll see, we've got some enhancement of biological control, but I want also in that case study to highlight the wider benefits of diversity. And then towards the end of my talk, depending on just how much time is available and how strict Phyllis is feeling, I'll give you just a glimpse of a few other systems in which similar approaches are being explored. So shelter belts, otherwise known as windbreaks, are really widely used around the world and increasingly popular in Australia for reasons not related to pest management. They're in there for catchment hydrology to manage the recharge of water into the groundwater system and thereby prevent big problems that we otherwise have with soil salinity. So that's the real driver for shelter belts or windbreaks going into Australia. They also, of course, will provide shelter for crops and shelter for livestock, but the main reason that farmers historically have been putting them in is for those issues that I've just touched on, not as a way of enhancing biocontrol. In fact, shelter belts are extraordinarily hard to get established in Australia, because they get absolutely hammered by all sorts of herbivores, like this Christmas beetle that you can see here. And so it's, as I say, very difficult to establish shelter belts in the first place. So we received quite a large grant from an Australian organisation called the Rural Industries R&D Corporation, and they wanted us to look at two things. One, how we might improve pest management within the shelter belts, so pests of the trees, but also how we could tweak those shelter belts in terms of their botanical diversity to provide benefit for wildlife conservation on farms. So let me talk about the first experiment then. This was in a young shelter belt here. As I mentioned a moment ago, these are really hard to establish because they're attacked so heavily by native herbivorous arthropods. And so this is where I'm actually going to talk about cover crops for a while, Phyllis. We tried putting in Lobularia maritima, commonly known as alyssum or sweet alyssum, and as many of you will know, this plant has been used in lots and lots of habitat manipulation or conservation biocontrol studies around the world in all sorts of systems. It's known to be a really good source of nectar for all sorts of parasitoids. So we established this in the field. I won't talk in any great detail about methods, but you can ask questions about that later on if you like. Let me dive straight into some of the results. So the abundance of arthropods in the plots where the Lobularia maritima, the flowering ground cover, was established versus our control treatment in which the existing grassy sward was left intact. As you can see here, the numbers of individual natural enemies caught in vacuum samples was about ninefold higher in the ground cover treatment than the grassy treatment. And for the herbivores, there was no significant increase. For the other category, this is non-natural enemies, non-herbivores, they did increase quite markedly. These were mostly what we call in Australia face flies, things that buzz around your nostrils when you're trying to do field work and make life uncomfortable. What about species richness? Again, we're looking at vacuum collected samples here. And as you can see, of those three kind of mega guilds, it was only the natural enemies that increased. And there, the numbers of species was more than doubled by the ground cover treatment. If we drill down and look at some of the particular natural enemy families that were favoured, we'll see quite interestingly perhaps that spiders responded very strongly to the presence of that ground cover. And as we heard in a session earlier today, it's now growingly accepted that spiders will take nectar. So maybe there's an effect via that direct mechanism for spiders in that system. And then down below there, of course, for these different Hymenoptera and parasitoid families, we've got, as you can see, statistically significant effects for a whole range of different paras. Well, so much for what you might refer to as census data. And as an ecologist, you can only get so excited about like numbers of insects and numbers of species. The really interesting stuff, especially from a pest management perspective, is the process rate. You know, just how much extra biological control are we getting as a result of the ground covers that are in place there? Now, luckily for us, these trees in our experiment were naturally infested with a galichid pest. These larvae, they'll kind of stitch a couple of leaves together and feed in that protected environment, and they can cause quite severe defoliation. And we were able to look at the larvae of this Lepidopteran on the trees, and we found a number of different parasitoids that were attacking them. And so we decided to take leaf samples and culture those in the lab to rear out the parasitoids. I'm sorry, it went too quickly there. There we go. So these data and the other stuff that I've been showing you earlier will be out very soon in biocontrol. But the overall message here is that both 1 month after the establishment of our ground covers, that's these left-hand bars, but also rather later in the year, 6 months after establishment of the ground covers. As you can see from the cross-hatched section of these bars here, we had significantly more parasitism of that Lepidopteran pest in the ground cover treatment than in the control treatment. But before we get too carried away in kind of celebrating our success, you know, thinking we've increased parasitism with this key pest, as you'll have noticed, the absolute number of the herbivores, the host insects, is greater here in the ground cover treatment than the control treatment, an effect that's also evident in the second sample occasion. Okay, so a couple of important things to point out there. The increased rate of parasitism in the ground cover treatment could be due, at least in part, to an aggregative response by the parasitoids simply concentrating their search activities on the trees where the host insects were most common. But perhaps even more fundamentally, it's showing us that ground covers can have a kind of a twist in the tail, in other words, a downside to them, in that they can be providing resources for pests. And of course, for many Lepidoptera, they're gonna think it's Christmas when you start providing flowering plants there, because they'll readily take nectar, be attracted, and potentially have their fecundity increased. So really, ground cover plants in that particular system, at least the use of alyssum, not a terrific idea. And that's that kind of warning message is perhaps amplified when you start to look at a couple of other herbivore groups. And you can see here for both tortoise beetles, these things here, and the click beetles, they were also markedly benefited by the presence of the ground cover treatment, as were psyllids, the sucking pests. So, to a degree, we gave up on cover crops in that particular system, and we thought we'd take a slightly different direction in that project. And that was, well, rather than going into this kind of interventionist mode and adding a ground cover to a shelter belt, let's look a bit more closely at the intrinsic diversity of shelter belts. And as we looked around farms in our region, which is in the inland part of New South Wales and Australia, it struck us that just how different the shelter belts were. Some were well and truly a monocrop, is that the word? I've got a mental block there. Just like one species, eucalyptus, one species of eucalyptus. Livestock were a monoculture, that's the word I was looking for. Livestock are allowed to graze underneath, so there's no ground cover. So really, you know, quite a simple sort of vegetational community, whereas others consisted of a range of different tree and shrub species. They weren't grazed, and so often would have a very rich ground cover and understory. And so the question was, you know, just how much does that matter in terms of pest activity? So the way in which we tried to get a handle on that was by kind of adding to these different shelter belts a kind of a biological probe or a known standard. What I mean by that is that we planted young trees of Eucalyptus blakeleyi, and they were planted into the ground into 18 shelter belts which fell across that wide range of botanical diversity. And then superimposed onto that design was three different levels of caging, either uncaged, like this one of course, or covered in a cage made of mosquito mesh, which kept out all but the tiniest of arthropods, or else caged with a fabric that's used commercially in vineyards to keep bird pests off of grapes. And so that gave us scope to kind of interrogate the system and try and see what sort of effects might be brought about by excluding certain sorts of potential natural enemies. Now, this project I'm talking about was actually two PhDs, so as you can imagine, a huge amount of data was generated. So I've only got time to show you kind of a few edited highlights from this, but if you're interested, we can talk some more, perhaps over coffee later on. But just to give you a flavour of the results, we used sentinel baits consisting of Citatroga eggs, and the most remarkable thing about this was that as the habitat complexity increased, and perhaps I should take a moment to explain that for those that aren't familiar with this metric. Habitat complexity is a way of assessing a habitat both in terms of the vegetational diversity, like how many shrubs and trees and grassy or herbaceous ground covers there are, but also the abiotic components, like dead wood, fallen wood on the ground, rocks, and this sort of thing. Okay, so habitat complexity is a bit more than botanical diversity, but it's kind of similar. Anyway, as that increases, as habitat complexity increases, you can see that the strongest effect that we got on predation of eggs on those egg cards was on this red line here, showing the response of our exposed trees, okay? So trees that didn't have either the bird-proof or the insect-proof mesh. So straight away that starts to suggest that maybe it's things that are being kept out by both the bird-proof mesh as well as the insect-proof mesh that might be important in predating these Citatroga eggs. Okay, so let's look first of all at some of the arthropods. And we, of course, found many, many different taxa were influenced, but I'm just showing you here a couple of the clearest relationships for two of the dominant parasitoid families. As you can see, once again, as habitat complexity score increases, so too did the catches of these parasitoid wasps. We also spent quite a bit of time mist netting, catching birds from these sites, and then keeping them in a box for a short while to give them a bit of a fright, and they would leave behind a little present for us in the form of feces, and we could then examine that for what arthropod fragments were present, and the fragments were identified against standard fragments that we generated by shaking known insects with ball bearings to simulate the activity of the insect crop. So we did this for quite a few different bird species, but again, just to give you something of a flavour for what came out of that study, we found that this particular finch, its diet composed very strongly of wingless grasshopper, this blue chunk of our pie chart. And wingless grasshoppers are amongst the most serious pests of shelter belts in Australia. So we're fairly confident now in our dealings with landholders to say that if you put these shelter belts in, especially floristically diverse ones that encourage birds, not only is it going to be useful habitat for the bird life, but also the birds might be providing the ecosystem service of eating pests for them. And growers always ask you tricky questions like, well, okay, you say that the more trees, the better. You know, just how many trees should we be aiming for? Give us some precise guidelines. And luckily, in this instance, our study was comprehensive enough to give some reasonably clear directions. And the font size is a bit small here, but perhaps you can make it out. The x-axis on all of these figures is the woody plant genus richness. And in this first figure here, we're looking at the density of insectivorous birds. And here, this isn't terribly helpful. This simply tells us that the more genera of plants we have in there, the more insectivorous birds you'll have. What's slightly more useful, perhaps, is these next two, B and C, where we do get a sort of a plateauing out, such that around seven genera, we're reaching our peak in terms of the species richness of insectivorous birds. And down here, the diversity of insectivorous birds is peaking at about four genera of woody plants. So that, you know, we can now enter into a slightly more meaningful discussion with growers about precise recommendations for what they should be planting in shelter belts. Bats were another fascinating aspect of this study, and we used harp trapping to catch these at night. And we also used acoustic detection equipment to monitor their feeding activity. And we were quite surprised at the extent to which bats were visiting even quite young shelter belts on farmlands and using these as feeding habitats. And once again, we caught quite a few bats and collected fecal samples, and once again found that pest taxa, as you might imagine, were quite an important component of the diet of many of these bat species. So just a few conclusions about this shelter belt pastoral system before I move on and give you a brief look at a few of the other systems in which we've been doing some work. From that initial study that I showed you where we worked in a young shelter belt, it was clear that ground covers can markedly affect natural enemies in the system. But of course, it also provided that sort of warning lesson that unless we are very careful about the choice of plant we use as a ground cover, then that can end up exacerbating the pest problem rather than being part of the solution. And then in terms of the intrinsic diversity of established shelter belts, once again, I think it's very clear that the botanical diversity of the shelter belt can markedly affect natural enemies. But despite the fact that we're all entomologists, we need to not be overly kind of blinkered in our thinking and realize that the vertebrates are not only targets for wildlife conservation, they might be providing an ecosystem service in terms of pest control. How are we going for time, Phyllis? It's good? 10 minutes. Great. Okay, so let's move on and do kind of a brief cameo appearance of a few other sorts of projects. We've been doing a fair amount of work in vineyards, and once again, alyssum was one of the plants that we looked at, and in fact it was the very best plant. We looked at a total of 8 different plant species, but it was only this one that had the unique ability to preferentially favour biological control without providing benefit to the pests. So in this particular study, we'd overcome that problem that I talked of earlier in the shelter belt experiment. So alyssum was used by an egg parasitoid called Trichogramma carvarei, which is an important biocontrol agent of light brown apple moth, a torticid pest. In fact, this is the major insect pest of grapevines in Australia. But the neat thing was that of all the plant species that we screened, this was the only one that didn't provide any benefit either to the adult light brown apple moth. It wasn't taking the nectar from alyssum, and also the caterpillars of light brown apple moth were not feeding on the foliage of alyssum. So we're able to say with a high degree of confidence, both in terms of laboratory experiments and also field evaluation, that if growers put this into their vineyard in the drip line beneath the vines themselves, then it won't be a case of pests being exacerbated. Not only did this increase the activity of our key parasitoid, Trichogramma, it also increased the level of predation of eggs from egg cards, but I'll be honest with you, we don't know what predator species were responsible there. That particular project wound up before we had a chance to do any detailed observational work to see what predators were being enhanced by the alyssum ground cover. But here's where it starts to get really interesting, I think, because growers are getting very excited about this approach because of the supplementary ecosystem services or benefits that having this living mulch beneath the vine row might provide. Growers are almost paranoid about weeds growing up in this area immediately beneath the vine. They're not so worried about the vegetation or weeds in the inter-row area, but weeds here drive them crazy because that reduces the airflow beneath the panel, and as soon as you reduce the airflow, that means that at the colder times of the year, the heavier cold air can't drain freely down the vineyard, and so you get elevated frost damage to the flowers and the young berries of the vine. And also, of course, as you might imagine, you get an increased level of humidity within the vineyard, and that can lead to more fungal diseases. So the growers that I'm speaking with are quite excited about having Alisson because it's prostrate, and so it will still allow ready airflow beneath the vine panel, but also as a living mulch, it will exclude the growth of taller weeds that would have those downsides that I've just been talking about. So I think vineyard ground covers have got a very, very bright future, both in Australia and elsewhere. I'd like to take you up on a journey to Papua New Guinea now, the island of New Britain, which is off of the northeastern coast of the PNG mainland. Very beautiful area, as you can see there, but an extremely difficult place to do research. The security situation is rather tricky, and laboratory infrastructure is rather basic. But we've been doing our best to do work up there on oil palm. And before any of you kind of race away with the thought that I'm some sort of ogre because I'm working on oil palm with all of the bad press that it's had, there aren't any orangutans in Papua New Guinea. There never have been. And I've seen firsthand the benefits that oil palm as a cash crop has had for the indigenous people up there, and their quality of life has increased quite markedly in the past decade by the introduction of oil palm as a cash crop for them. So for my sins, yes, I work on oil palm. In that system, cover crops are really important already, but not for biocontrol. As you can perhaps make out, there's a massive kind of... a massive mound here running up between these two rows of oil palm trees. And what's happening is that the trees are quite intensively managed because they're very, very valuable. And the fronds that are cut off of these trees are dumped in these windrows along every second row. And then these ground covers are allowed to grow over them to speed up the decomposition of the plant debris as a phytosanitary measure. And so we got interested in the extent to which, or the scope for, these ground covers might be used to get supplementary benefits in the form of biological control. And the whole reason for this is that our work up there is focused on a very serious problem known there as Finch-Harfen disorder, which causes yellowing and yield loss on the palms. You can see symptoms here. And although the study is in very early days, we believe it's caused by a rather spectacular plant hopper called Zophiuma lobulata. And so we've done quite a bit of work prospecting for natural enemies of Zophiuma and found that egg parasitoids, especially mimerids, attack the egg masses of this plant hopper in quite large numbers. And so to put a few of these elements together, on a recent trip up to Papua New Guinea, I was involved in some very basic preliminary bioassays to see if any of these plants, which are commonly found in the plantation areas, might have scope to be ground covers that can be grown over those frond prunings to hasten their decomposition, but at the same time provide nectar for these parasitoids that will attack the Zophiuma plant hopper pest. And although we've only done very simple bioassays so far, they're looking quite encouraging, and for the mimerids at least there appears to be a response in terms of longevity of the adults to the presence of flower nectar. And as we speak, one of my postdocs, Catherine Gitto, is back up there in PNG doing some more sophisticated studies to explore that line of investigation. I'd now like to just spend the last few minutes of my talk discussing a relatively new initiative. And this is using the sorts of approaches that I've been talking about in rice. And as you'd be aware, rice was one of those sort of wonder crops of the Green Revolution, where Wiesbang host plant resistance, mostly based on major genes, was introduced, and whole generations of new pesticides were brought to the market. And for a while at least, these were stunningly effective, and rice yields in Asia were increased very markedly. But in the past few years, both the pesticides and the major gene host plant resistance have been failing in quite a spectacular fashion. And so, somewhat late, arguably, the rice-growing nations are looking towards ecological approaches to try and deal with rice pest problems in a slightly more sustainable fashion. Now, this chap here, Dr. Xia, he heads up the Chinese Organization for Agricultural and Technology Extension. It's basically the extension arm of the Beijing government. And he organized this workshop, a huge workshop in southern China 2 months ago. And that, I'm told, this banner translates to eco-engineering for rice pest management. And at this workshop, we were laying in place plans to inject these cover crop and related technologies for rice pest management. And it was kind of fun. It was the only time I can think of where I've been out doing field work with a police escort, front and rear of the convoy of vehicles. And we had the governor of Gansu province come along to see what we're about and attracting media attention. And so we think as a kind of an outcome of that workshop, there's great potential to manipulate rice production systems in a number of ways that will increase biological control. So that's what's happening specifically in China. It's going to be farmer participatory research using five villages where eco-engineering will be implemented across 2,000 hectares, and then five other villages that will be kept as a control treatment, and we'll be able to track the success or otherwise of the system over time. And we're about to sign contracts in an Asia Development Bank funded project which the International Rice Research Institute are leading. And this is doing broadly similar work, but the geographical scope of it is much greater. As well as working in China, we're also working in Cambodia, Vietnam, and Malaysia. And just one of the ideas that we're exploring here is to address the fact that rice growing is pretty much a monoculture. And as you look across a rice growing landscape, very often the amount of botanical diversity is very low, except perhaps sometimes on the bunds, these earthen banks that are used to kind of contain irrigation water. And we believe that there's great scope to research the flowering plants that could be grown on these bunds to increase parasitoids of rice brown plant hopper and other rice pests. Okay, so let me just, in the last moment or so, bring things to a few broad conclusions. I think cover crops and related forms of vegetation have got great utility in a whole host of different agricultural systems. And as I've tried to indicate there's mounting interest in developing countries, which I think is a great thing to see. When doing research on this approach to pest management, I think we need to think broadly and not just about adding a given ground cover species to the system, but also look at the current vegetation and see whether that might be useful itself or amenable to some minor modification, as perhaps was illustrated in that shelter belt case study that I started off with. And of course, great caution is required in species choice if we are going to add a different plant species to the system, because there's every possibility of herbivore enhancement, as I showed you in that shelter belt case study. But there are ways around that, and there the brief look we had of the vineyard case study shows that if sufficient research is done, you can often find a plant species that would be adequately selective and benefit the natural enemy without benefiting the pest. Birds and bats might also be useful as biological control agents, in addition to them being the targets for wildlife conservation on farms. And if we can set this system up properly, we might potentially get a whole suite of additional ecosystem services. So things like catchment hydrology and carbon sequestration, the aesthetics, maybe the cover crops might be a dual crop. We might get weed suppression, as I tried to show you in the vineyard system, and pollination. And on that note, I'll leave my acknowledgements up there for you to read. And if there are questions or time for questions, I'll do my best to answer them. Rufus. Okay, so Rufus Isaacs was asking, why is it we got such different results between the vineyard system and the shelter belt system when, after all, the cover crop plant being used was the same one? It was alyssum in both cases. And I can only assume that the answer there, Rufus, is the leaf tire, the galichid, the pest in our shelter belt system, really liked taking nectar from the alyssum plants, but that's a supposition. What I can say with certainty is that light brown apple moth didn't take nectar from alyssum. We showed that quite convincingly in laboratory bioassays. Thank you.